and working toward the corners. It's in June, isn't it? Do you have a date in mind? As if all I have to do is think of a guy, and one will appear. I'm about to shrug it off, but this gives me a window. Jessa wants to look at dresses tomorrow, before all the good ones are sold out. I sigh and cast my eyes downward. But I don't think I'm going.
You've still got time to shop.
No, I don't think I'm going to prom. She clinks her fork onto her plate, eyebrows screwing together.
I won't say you should go, but that seems like a rash decision.
It's not rash, it's practical. I don't even have a boy to take me.
It sounds pathetic. I have to swallow a healthy dose of self-loathing to get the words out, but I know the answer that's coming.
Oh, Immy, you don't need a boy to go to your prom.
No, I guess not, I reluctantly admit, tracing gloomy squiggles in my mashed butternut squash. But boys usually buy the tickets. That's how the school does things, and it'll look weird if I do.
That's ridiculous, not to mention a complete throwback to the 50s. You just march in and buy your own ticket.
I snort. Me and what trust fund? Confident that she's facing a problem she can solve, Lindy picks up her fork and digs back in.
Well, don't worry about that. How much are tickets?
Who knows? But first I have to buy a dress and shoes and... I don't know.
Then the clincher.
Also, I can show up without a date?
Imogene May Scott!
You need to realize that you're a strong young woman who is perfectly capable of having a great time sans male.
Tell me what you need.
Thanks, Lindy.
I gush, my smile genuine.
Of course.
She pats my hand across the table, then clears her throat.
You know, while you were with Jessa yesterday, I spoke with Officer Griffin.
I look at her. She smiles. Weakly, but at least she's still wearing her work lipstick, and her hair is smoothed back in a French twist, so she looks more herself.
It's not... There isn't any information yet. But Officer Griffin thinks my idea of getting the media involved might be helpful.
The media?
What, like newspapers, TV?
Both. She thinks the story could really get some traction considering your dad's well known. To some, anyway. People could really pay attention. And the more people who pay attention, the greater the likelihood that someone will see something.
It might help us find him, just in case he isn't heading back this way already.
It's only been a few days. Can't we wait?
I stand. I can just see some Fox 25 reporter in her ice cream colored suit and plastic makeup delivering the line,
"A local mystery writer is now the star of his own mystery."
Lindy looks up at me, her eyes sharpening. I now see the veins in them, the swelling in the soft pink corners I've been ignoring all this time.
This isn't the kind of decision we should be putting off. You're not a little girl, Imogene. You have a crucial role in this family, and I want you to be a part of these decisions. I need you with me. I need you to understand.
I know you're worried.
You must be worried too, Immy, even if you won't admit it.
On the one hand, I can practically hear my shoulders creak under the weight of everything I know and everything she doesn't.
She looks so sad, with her swimming eyes. But on the other hand, knowing what Dad is up to when no one else does almost feels like a superpower.
And isn't it?
Sherlock Holmes is a morphine and coke addict and depressed as hell. Dirk Gently from Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency is a fat gambler who was once arrested for physically plagiarizing exam papers. Nero Wolfe from Over My Dead Body drinks like a fish during Prohibition, keeps track of his boozing by stashing the bottle caps in his desk. And Miles Fay? In 10 books. He never once had an actual relationship, and every friend of his we hear about is a dead friend. All the great detectives are screwed up somehow, and those are just the men.
But they have the truth. They have the big answer. Isn't that the best power there is?
But I couldn't tell Lindy the truth if I wanted. I don't have it yet, so I duck the question.
Even Officer Griffin said he was like... in control of his faculties, that he knows what he's doing.
You heard that?
She sighs and digs purposefully into her stir-fry. I stand. Let her think it's too hard for me to talk about, if it will end this horrible conversation. I just want to go shopping with Jessa tomorrow. Is it okay if I go to bed early?
Of course, Immy. Of course. I'll leave you some cash tonight for an outfit, to start.
Thanks. I give my plate a lazy rinse in the sink, jam it in the dishwasher, and retreat to my room. Like the rest of the house, my bedroom contains the same stuff it always has. Same twin bed, same sun-washed blinds, same pictures on the hand-me-down desk. Every book I've ever read, even the bad ones. I wouldn't throw away a book any more than I'd toss a pet out on the street, if I'd had any pets since my ill-fated goldfish. Rebecca is currently being used as a coaster. I flop onto the unmade bed and reach into my book bag, extracting my copy of A Time to Chill, the stone heart, and the stack of photos. All of these I tuck into my nightstand drawer, except for one picture. Mom on the lawn of her childhood home, in front of the forked paper birch, the chain-link fence, the queasy storm sky. On the drive home from the ski slopes, Jessa tried dialing Lil's number to get an address a couple times, but she never picked up, and she never returned our messages, so no help's coming from her. I squint at the small white house behind my mother. An American flag dangles from the lamppost along the front walk, limp and greasy-looking. If there's a number on the door, I can't see it. In the next picture of Mom and Lil, they stand on the lawn of the church, a steeple towering over them with a pale green roof. I pull my own laptop from the desk. Speaking of problems that never crop up in detective stories these days, where's a genius computer hacker when I need one? The main mystery solver always has a friend they can go to and say, "Hey, Sullivan, the perp seems to have disappeared by the old town hall." Then Sullivan sits at the computer, cracks his neck, and with a little pitter-patter on the keyboard, he says, "Okay, I've accessed the security footage for the past 24 hours from the bank across the street, and here he is going into the storm drain behind the pretzel shack." A friend like that could, I don't know, break into the Fitchburg real estate records and find the Fays and the Ward's old addresses in a heartbeat. My Watson is busy eating dinner with her own family up the road, so I've got work to do before I get her back tomorrow morning.
13. "Since when are you busy?"
Jessa sighs over the phone.
I know. Sucks, right? I totally forgot. I promised Mom we'd have a girls' day before this big pediatric conference she's going to, and this is her only day off all week. She booked us a treatment for two at In Your Facial, that spa in Newton, and she paid ahead of time.
Okay, I understand.
I'm really, really sorry. Trust me, Em, I'd rather go to Fitchburg with you than get a candlelight couples massage with my mother.
Pressing my free ear against my bedroom door, I can clearly hear Lindy down in the kitchen. Right about now, she'll be scanning the political section of the morning paper and eating her usual breakfast. One cup Greek yogurt, one hard-boiled egg minus the yolk, two cups basic black coffee. I've got 10 minutes till she marches upstairs to pack her briefcase, pops her head in my room to say goodbye, and is out the door by 8:45, after which I'd planned to pick up my partner. Sherlock Holmes was never stymied by Watson's pedicure appointments, but Jessa has plans with her mom, and I can't judge her for that. I wouldn't even know how.
No, it's completely okay. Of course you should go. I'll be fine on my own.
Excuse you? She scoffs. You may not go to a strange city and knock on strangers' doors alone. You will so get kidnapped, and I won't know how to find you without you.
I won't get kidnapped because I'm not a kid.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what everyone says before they get kidnapped. But hey, Chad can totally go with you. He's not working and he doesn't have class on Tuesdays.
I'm not dragging your brother. Chadwick!
She shouts into the speaker. I cringe.
Jessa, no!
I'm not letting you go if you don't take someone with you. So who else? Maybe that policewoman? Maybe Lindy?
A harsh point. But honestly,
I've sort of gotten used to having someone in the passenger seat, and if nothing else, I could use a navigator. So after I shower and scrape my hair into a neat ponytail, and at the last moment stuff a Ziploc bag of Lucky Charms into my coat pocket, I drive over to the Price's house. A miserable-looking Jessa waves at me from their bay window, while Chad slides into the frost-fogged car, slumping down in his jacket with the ski pass permanently affixed to the zipper. He palms back the white blonde jumble of his hair and yawns, rubs his eyes with the heel of one hand.
Cold one, huh?
So now we're talking about the weather. I fiddle with the heating vents to delay conversation, like the coffee Lindy left in the pot Thursday night. Bitter to begin with, and by Friday morning, toxic. The awkwardness between us is exponentially worse in the daylight. I only make it halfway down Cedar before pulling onto a dead-end side street and throwing the Civic into park. We know you know something's going on. Carefully, Chad watches a pack of boys in winter jackets and athletic shorts wrestle for a basketball below a hoop at the end of the cul-de-sac.
It's your secret, Imogene. I'm sorry Jessa opened her mouth. You really don't need to tell me.
Untrue. I have to give him something if I want him to look at me the way he used to, and not as a doctor in training trying to diagnose the wounded. I breathe deeply. We've been trying to find my dad, but I think, I know, Dad is looking for my mother. My real mom, I mean, who left when I was 2 years old. So, I am too. It's complicated.
Sounds like it.
He whistles low.
That's heavy stuff.
But thanks to you, we've kind of got a lead. Dr. Sorbasek told us that my mother said she was going back home, and we know she's from Fitchburg originally, so...
So that's where we're headed. Makes sense. But... Are you okay?
There's that question again. Always. I quote my dad with a smile, hoping I sound so much cooler than I feel. Then Chad looks at me, studies me with perfect sea-glass green eyes, and for a heart-pumping second, I'm carried away by butterflies. No bigger. By full-size Victoria-crowned pigeons.
You're so tough, Imogene Scott.
He not quite smiles back.
How did you get to be so tough?
Later, I'll come up with 1,000 possible retorts. For now, I can only shrug and stare helplessly back until he flashes a dimple and shakes his head.
So what's the plan when we get there?
I perk up. My own strategic genius is a safer topic. And drop the envelope of bills Lindy left for me in his lap. $200. Seems like way too much money for a prom dress, but I'm not complaining. Fitchburg's more than an hour northwest, and my car is running on fumes and hope. He flips through the cash, then sits up straighter.
Holy bankroll. Are we opening a meth lab?
We're buying a prom dress, I air quote.
Oh, well, now I understand why Jessa thought I should come along.
I throw the car into drive, and once we're moving forward again, I feel tough, which is exactly what I want to be. Tough means strong. It means even if you're sad, or God forbid lonely, you won't crumble like a dry granola bar in the bottom of a backpack, destined to spill out over the lap of the first person who fumbles open your foil wrapper. Tough is the opposite of troubled waters. Calvinistic congregational is beautiful. Old, ornate, and red-bricked, with a roof the light green color of weather-beaten copper, like the Statue of Liberty. It's the only building in Fitchburg I could find that matches the one in the photo of Lil and my mom. Chad and I stand on the sidewalk outside and tilt our heads back to examine the steepled clock towers from below.
That's a church, Chad says.
I agree. I turn in circles on the concrete. Behind us is Main Street, and beyond that is the Fitchburg Art Museum, which Wikipedia called one of the most treasured cultural institutions in central New England. A pretty high bar, considering the gallery of crayon-colored kids' placemats above the register at Bingo's Breakfast in Sugarbrook.
All around the church are businesses, some in old-style brick and brown stone, some in new but not particularly shiny white buildings. There's something labeled a theater guild, a thrift store called Odds and Ends, a credit union, restaurants. According to Google Maps, the nearest homes lie directly northwest. But we don't walk straight there. Shoving our hands into our pockets against the cold, the semi-warmth of last Wednesday at Victory Island has yet to be repeated. We plod a little ways down Circle Street, which crosses over a thin river, and there in front of us lies Crocker Field, the park where my mom and Lil used to stop on their way home from church. It's huge, ringed by a track and circled by tall trees, with painted lines for all kinds of sports. Probably it's gotten fancier since Mom was a kid. "Did you ever play here?" I asked Chad.
"A couple of times in Fitchburg, yeah, but not in this park.
Weren't you at one of the games?
When Fitchburg's midfielder got hurt?"
"That's right, I was. I used to tag along with the Prices to games, because why wouldn't I watch Chad's thighs sprint across a soccer field in nylon shorts? But the game Chad's talking about happened when he was a junior, and he collided with a boy in the center of the field. They went down together with a terrible dry sound I swear you could hear from the bleachers, like the husk being ripped from a corn cob. Nobody knew whose body had broken until Chad untangled himself and bounced away, flushed and shaking but fine. The other boy wasn't. He'd shredded his knee. After that, I got this sick, nervous feeling I couldn't control whenever I went to one of Chad's matches."
"Huh, I don't remember that."
I shrug and we keep going, all the way around the field onto Broad Street and then River Street, which spits us back onto Main, a ways up from the church.
"Maybe we should go get the car and drive around for a while," Chad suggests.
I chew the inside of my lip until I realize it's Jess's nervous habit.
"The house has to be close. My mom, she could hear the baseball games from the backyard. It must be one of these streets."
We cut across light traffic on Main Street and head up Chestnut, the first residential street nearest the field, comparing the houses on either side of the road to the photo clutched in my fingers. Their matted brown lawns peek through a dusting of snow that came in the night. Christmas lights still cling to one or two gutters, but I don't see the house, and Chestnut dead ends after a block and a half. We backtrack to the cross street, Arlington, and head left in the direction of the field. That takes us to Prospect, where the houses seem entirely too big, thinning out into businesses just a little down the road.
Maybe this won't work after all. Maybe I won't recognize the house, or Lil was totally exaggerating when she said she could practically smell the ballpark hot dogs.
I pry my phone out of my pocket and try her number again. No answer, and because I was too preoccupied with research to charge it last night, my phone is blinking on its last battery bar. So we're on our own for now. There's a whole web of residential streets here, spinning through the trees. On Google Maps, it looks totally doable. On the ground, it's a different story. And what do I expect to find anyway? Whether the stone in my satchel's front pocket is my grandmother's heart or not, she's dead for certain. Lil said Mom's father was gone too, and even if Mom did come home, what was left in her childhood house to come back to? Who knows if the people living there can even help me? Still, I have to start somewhere. And even though Fitchburg is bigger than Sugarbrook, it's an old town, and this is an old neighborhood. And just like in Sugarbrook, neighborhoods love to talk. And if there's one thing they like to talk about best, it's their sons and daughters. Where they are now, what they're doing, who's moved to the big city and become a smash success, who's been arrested and who got married and who came out of the closet and who died, and all the terrible things that happened to them along the way. We head in the opposite direction, a few blocks past a cross street. It seems like we're getting too far from the field, so we turn around and head down Bond, where, three houses in on the left, I grab Chad's swishy ski jacket. My heart hammers against my ribs. The little house isn't white. It's sort of a bluish purple, not even recently painted, and there's no flag hanging from the lamppost. But it has the same perfectly square windows. The chimney is in the right place, and though the tree in the yard is taller, it's definitely the forked white birch from the picture. I hold the photo up to be sure. Chad double-checks the picture and smiles. I think we found it. I tuck the photo in my jacket pocket and try to crack my knuckles before remembering I'm wearing puffy gloves. I guess we should ring the doorbell. He peels off his left glove, pulls my right glove off by the tips, and threads his fingers through mine. I don't even get to soak in the warmth of his skin. His calloused palm, before my traitorous hand, jerks away of its own free will. It's out of my control, like a sneeze. I can feel my cold cheeks warm, embarrassed. I didn't mean that. Sorry. He nods. Come on, tough guy. Why? Why is this the moment my imperfect but generally reliable brain misfires? Whatever the reason, I don't have time to think about it, because we're moving. Up the flagstone walk, up the steps to the miniature porch, toward the door with the little stained glass bumblebee sticky cup to the side window. I reach out my hand, now in control, if shaky, and ring the doorbell. And realize there's probably no one home, because it's 10:30 on a Tuesday, and we've come all this way for nothing. And really, what could these people have told me anyway, since all the fays are gone? The door opens.
Help you? Asks a man, eyeing us down the long wedge of his nose. Wearing only a Red Sox t-shirt and sweats over bare feet, he crosses his arms against the wind. Something tells me he's not a long-lost fay. I skim my tongue over my dry lips.
Yeah, yes, sorry to bother you. It's just, I'm doing a school project, and I, wondered if you might have a minute to help me?
Aren't you guys on break from school?
Scattered in the hallway behind him, I notice kid-colored backpacks and smallish sneakers with light-up bottoms.
I know, it sucks, right? Chad laughs. Homework over vacation?
I shrug in a, what are you going to do, way.
I don't know. I'm just off my night shift, about to head to bed. You're not selling magazines or anything, are you?
No way, and just a second is all I need, I say gratefully. 1.5 seconds at most. See, we're supposed to do a report on our family history in the area, and my mom, she has this cousin I never met. Sidoni Fay? They haven't talked in a while since Sidoni moved away, but Mom said she lived in this house growing up, and she thought Sidoni might have moved back into the area. I know it's a long shot, but I was just wondering if you knew her, if she might have come back here in the past few years.
This is a school project?
He lifts a bristly black eyebrow.
Yep.
For social studies? Applying big lessons to our little lives, you know. Oh, and I have a picture. I dig into my bag, pulling out the brochure from the Boston MFA. I flip to the exhibit photo and spread it out for the guy. I notice Chad examining it slyly, then looking at me. For comparison? The man in the Sox t-shirt shrugs.
Tell you the truth, we just moved in 3 years ago and we didn't buy the house from a fay. You know, you might ask? Tilly Donahue.
He points to a squat brown house 2 properties down, its lawn potholed with grassless patches, plastic pinwheels poking up through the gnarly shrubs around the porch.
She's lived here some 50 years, got her nose in everybody's business. Let's say she knows when the mayor takes a squat.
Uh-huh. So she's usually home?
Right now, she's at, what do you call, water aerobics or something. For old people. Her home aide will bring her back around 1:30, after they do their shopping. I know this because she comes knocking every damn day at 1:45 to change a bulb or fix her doorbell or some nonsense. And I work nights, you know?
Right, yeah. I'll definitely check with her. Thanks for your time. Chad nods his thanks, and we leave his porch as the door shuts tight, the bumblebee rattling in the window.
So,
he blows into his cupped hands.
We stand on the front walk under a tent of thick gray clouds, without anywhere in particular to go. It's not even 11 now. That's a lot of time to be alone with Chad Price.
I guess we could sit somewhere, get coffee or something, I offer. There must be a coffee place or two in Fitchburg, a Starbucks at least. With my petty cash, I can even afford to put whipped cream in mine.
Chad taps a finger against his chin.
Or we could find you a prom dress.
I stare at him.
Isn't that your alibi?
It wasn't an alibi so much as a lie.
So what'll you tell Lindy when you come home with no dress?
And what will you do when prom comes?
Tell her you're going and then run and hide in the attic?
He pokes my shoulder, though I can't really feel it through the down in my coat.
You've lied yourself into a corner, Imogene. And that is the corner of the Sugarbrook Gymnasium on prom night.
What do you think the theme will be?
Ours was, "This recession has really killed our prom budget."
I remember Chad's prom night. I saw it happening from the window in my living room, having elbowed aside the old plaid drapes. My fingers were chalked orange from the supersized tub of cheese doodles wedged between newlyweds Dad and Lindy on the sofa. They were settling in to watch The Thin Man. It was Dad's 111th viewing and Lindy's first. As the opening credits ran, I spied on Chad and his date, Beth Holmes, posing for pictures in the Price's driveway. From a block away, they were only specks. Him black and white in his suit, her glittering in blue, a diamond that had caught the sun. Beth was not only the girls' tennis team captain, she was president of Key Club, the collection of mostly popular girls who rang bells for the Salvation Army around the holidays, organized G-rated car washes for the local animal shelters in the spring, stuff like that. Though I couldn't see the details from that distance, I could imagine them. Her tennis arms, her petal pink lipstick, her signature fruity perfume smell. And not cheap fruity, like girls who bought spritzers and plastic spray bottles at Walmart. Expensive designer fruity. Pomegranate with hints of saffron and ancient redwood or something. I watched their shiny shell-white limo glide by, knowing Jessa and Jeremy were in there too, behind the black windows. Jessa was the only sophomore at prom that year, and in her gold dress and with her flat-ironed red-gold hair, she looked like a living Oscar statuette. She looked fantastic in every picture I saw of her afterward, and I saw so many. When May rolls around, she'll go with Jeremy again, I'm sure. I was planning on staying home and watching Ace in the Hole with Dad, or maybe going for our traditional spicy Italian on flatbread and chicken bacon ranch melt in our booth by the door for old time's sake. But Chad's right. I have lied myself into a corner, unless the school gym burns down.
Could I burn the school gym down?
I could not. I flail around for a reasonable excuse, landing on, if I spend all my cash on a prom dress, I won't have any money for gas. I'll be right back where I started.
He taps his chin again as he thinks.
So? Get a cheap dress.
I give him the side eye.
Oh, come on. You could find something at Home Depot and it'd look better on you than all the girls who shopped on Newbury.
Untrue. To hide my blush, I fiddle with the strap on my bag. And I don't think Home Depot sells prom dresses.
There's a thrift store in town.
Not thrift.
Consignment? We always stopped at the Olive Garden to eat after Fitchburg games, and there's a place next to it. It has tons of girly dresses in the window.
Little Mermaid style and everything.
Jessa said they were, like, cute for secondhand.
This doesn't seem like a productive use of our time.
A Lindyism, if ever I've repeated one.
He shrugs. It's your choice. But you're stuck, and you need to find something.
Unless you can weave a gown out of lies.
I'm hoping we won't find the store.
Unfortunately, Chad has a fantastic memory. Once we backtrack to the Calvinistic congregational parking lot and pick up my car, it doesn't take him long to find the Olive Garden and the thrift store. Sorry, consignment shop. Next to it. The bells above the door jingle as we slip into Suzanne's Dress for Less. A salesgirl waves at us and asks if we need any help, but I can't stop staring at the height of her fancy heels, like bamboo stilts. I wade cautiously toward the rack of dresses, along the back wall, while Chad plunges in. He pulls one out and holds it up at arm's length. It's scaly and slightly iridescent, a kind of mystery fabric that flashes olive green and copper and gold at certain angles.
Reptilian, he comments. Very cool.
I trail my fingertips across silk and sequins, and a lot of Frankenstein-style polyester blends. There's a knee-length pink thing that looks like an iced cupcake, and a long yellow gown shaped like a partially peeled banana. I find a shimmering silver dress and start to pick it up, but when I think of the one Jessa lent me, crumpled at the bottom of my hamper and smelling of rum and misery, I sour on the idea and shove it back. This is stupid. I'll think up an excuse before prom. Play sick somehow. Or Dad will get me out of it. Uneasiness simmers in the pit of my stomach. I shouldn't be thinking of prom or pretty dresses or Chad. Not when Dad's been away without a word for 6 days now. I try to check the time on my phone before discovering it's dead. Then pull Chad's wrist up to read the digits on his big calculator watch. 1 hour before Tilly is back from water aerobics for the ancient. 1 hour, and I might have some answers. What's 1 hour? I've waited 6 days. I can wait 60 minutes. Besides, he's not missing, I remind myself. Just searching, like I am.
How's this?
Chad plucks out a dress and dangles it by the hanger. And it's not terrible. Vintage-looking, but not old-fashioned. Deep red like wine, with a heart-shaped neckline, a high waist, and the kind of fold just below the knee skirt Jessa claims works for sizable thighs. It's the kind of dress a girl might wear in the old noir mysteries Dad likes. In those movies, a girl is either good or she's one of those girls, as Liz Bash would say. Either a Mrs. Maximilian de Winter or a Rebecca. This is the kind of dress one of those girls might wear when she's still acting sweet in front of the detective. But we, on our couches, with our cheese doodles, know she's trouble. It's a pretty sexy dress. A pretty sexy dress that Chad is holding out to me with one eyebrow raised and a smile I've never quite seen before. As I stand here considering it, I ask myself, what do I know? I know I've had this Guinness Book of World Records longest-running crush on Chad since 5th grade. I remember the exact night it happened. A girl in Jess's ballet class had told her how to summon Bloody Mary, and she wanted to play the game. Even kid-sized Jessa was pretty good at getting what she wanted. While she chanted the name 3 times in the flickering light of a glade candle, I stayed by the bathroom door, knowing that just outside, Chad had sweetly volunteered to stand guard, just in case Mary showed, he said. When he rattled the knob violently, I screamed, tripped over a wet towel that might have been Mary's grasping, bloodied arm on the dark bathroom floor, and burst out into Chad's arms, Jessa close behind, tucked into his then scrawny chest. He smelled like mint and strange spices at once, toothpaste and boy deodorant, I later realized. That was it. The die was cast. I have never asked a guy out in my life. Haven't even slipped one a do you like me circle yes or no note. Lee Jung asked me to be his girlfriend, and Jeff Keating asked to kiss me behind the bounce house at the low-budget Sugarbrook Fair that goes up in the mall parking lot each year. And A.J. Breen, the only boy to write me love letters, slipped a cartoon drawing of me drinking a milkshake into my trapper keeper in middle school, asking me to sit with him at lunch. But I never asked anything from a guy. What's the upside? The possible outcomes, as I see it, are 1. I'll like them, but they won't like me, resulting in pain. 2. We'll go out, and I'll realize I don't like them and have to dump them, resulting in pain. 3. We'll go out, and I'll end up really liking the boy, only to have him dump me for Cassie Pavia, who stands at the electronic pencil sharpener in front of Josh Davis's desk with her hip popped while Josh moans, "Cassie, you're killing me with that body." Result, pain. I mean, how are two people ever supposed to like each other the right moment, in the right way, at the right time? Impossible. But I also know that Chad Price is looking at me with big green eyes and one dimpled cheek, his blonde hair fuzzed from pawing through racks of fabric, all of this making me warm and misty, and he's offering me a beautiful dress that I want him to see me in. Are these random occurrences or fate? Unconnected dots or a constellation? And isn't this what I'm supposed to be doing? Having faith? For once, don't be tough, I tell myself. Be brave. I snatch the hanger away. I will try this on if... I inspect the crisp, red fabric, the size, seems right, the $55 price tag, about 40 more than I wanted to spend, the stitching along the neckline, like he believes I'm fascinated by the construction of this dress. If you put on a suit and come to prom, too. His smile wobbles, confused. Just, if I have to go, I don't see why you get off. You're my accomplice in this. I stare at the dress in his arms and wonder if he can sense the breath trapped in my body. I can see I've been tangled in your web of lies, he says, grinning again. Yeah, I'll go. I sweep off to the fitting rooms, keeping it together pretty well. But as I kick my boots and jeans off and slide into the gown, the fist of my heart unclenches, and maybe it's the blood flowing again, the air pumping in and out of my lungs. So much air, I can't get enough of it. And it all smells wonderful. And I know I shouldn't, but I feel so light. I'm a mayfly on the breeze, a balloon, a beam of moonlight, a sun. 14. While we wait in my car for Tilly Donahue's return from elderly water aerobics, the sky spits freezing rain that blurs the windshield. The last real clumps of snow beside the storm drains glitter dangerously. Fresh ice will make for a thrilling drive home. But it's dry in the Civic, the heater sputtering heroically onward, and Chad and I are playing the picnic game. I'm going to a picnic, and I'm bringing an apple, a barracuda, Captain Morgan, a deciduous pine, elephantiasis of the balls, a falafel truck, and Gaussian frequency shift keying. He smiles triumphant, little C's punctuating the corners of his lips. I bet you don't even know what that is. That is not a requirement in the picnic game. He grabs a fistful of Lucky Charms from my baggie, which we've been passing back and forth, and separates out the marshmallows, sorts them further in piles of balloons, horseshoes, rainbows. They all taste like sweet packing peanuts to me, but I like that he bothers. He dusts the cereal bits from his palm into my waiting hand, and his eyes light up. And I do so know what Gaussian frequency shift keying is, because we're doing a unit of FSK modulation in my engineering elective. It uses a Gaussian filter to... Fine. I dump the cereal in my mouth and sneak a look in the rearview mirror. My dress hangs in its black plastic garment bag in the back seat, like a promise. I'm going to a picnic and I'm bringing an apple, a barracuda, Captain Morgan, a deciduous pine, elephantiasis of the balls, a falafel truck, Gaussian frequency shift keying, and Hannah Montana. Chad's lip curls. Of all the picnics in the world, this is the worst. You couldn't bring Hillary Clinton? Take your Captain Morgan and your elephantiasis of the balls and go. Or keep playing. No, let's play a different game. Let's play I Spy. I hate that game, I protest. Nobody hates I Spy. I do. Oh, I Spy something gray. But it's February in New England. It's all gray. Okay. He tosses a marshmallow heart in the air and catches it with a click of his jaws. What about Would You Rather? I know this is his way of distracting me, but better a stupid game than sitting in a silent car, cracking my knuckles until they ache and feeling more nervous by the second. Okay, would you rather be able to read books or be able to read minds? I can't read books if I can read minds. One or the other. He drums two fingers against his lips, and I remember my fixation on his mouth in his basement bedroom. Reading minds would make it easier to be a doctor. But let's say books. I'm pretty sure the majority of minds are boring. At least in Sugarbrook they are. Present company excluded. A good answer. Would you rather... You already had your turn, Turntaker. Now it's mine. He roots around in the baggie for a last marshmallow bit and comes out empty. Would you rather be able to go to the future or be able to visit the past? Are we talking my past or the past of humanity? Your past, not like Oregon Trail and long underwear past. Easy, the past. The rain's falling a little heavier now. I watch it blacken Tilly's driveway and inky splatters. Why? What if the future's awesome? With global warming? Unlikely. And I like the past. It was nice. All our problems were easier. It's true. I mean, it wasn't all lollipops and Disney movies. But the past is safe. If I could visit, I'd find all the happy parts with Dad and me and live in them over and over. And besides, I honestly don't know what I want from my future anymore. Because at this moment, I have no idea what it will look like. If Tilly Donahue is the lead that helps me find my mom and dad, then what? I'm not wishing on a star for my biological parents to get back together, get married, book us all on a big family road trip. I know my mom's got real problems, so I don't believe that this time tomorrow we'll be outfitting the guest room in mom's favorite color. Blue, like dad's? Red, like mine? I don't know what the world will look like with all of us in it, but it has to be so much better than not knowing her. Chad nods. Yeah, I kind of miss my old problems, too. When losing your science textbook under your bed was this huge deal, and I could tell my mom I wanted to be a doctor without having to worry about actually being a doctor, or getting into the right programs, or the right hospital, or being happy. But you want to be a doctor, don't you? He gives a helpless little half-laugh. I'd better. So, what would you pick? The past or the future? When he looks at me and bites his lip, I feel my pulse in my ears, and I think this is what it feels like to really want a boy. Whether he would have picked the past or the future, I'll never find out, because a beige car pulls up the driveway of the little brown house. Tilly Donahue and her home aide, I presume. The aide slides out, waddles to the other side of the car, and gently pries the old woman out by the elbow. She guides her across the icy slick flagstones along the front walk. All I can see of Tilly is a cloud of permed white hair above the collar of her fur coat. Who wears a fur coat to water aerobics? Quickly they duck inside, out of the weather. Ready? Chad asks. Yeah, I whisper, then louder. Yes. When we're shivering and blinking frozen water out of our eyes on the sidewalk, he offers me his hand. In case I slip, he says, and smiles. I take it this time, and even though I'm out of the beautiful red dress that made all my weird curves look like they were supposed to be there, back in my hoodie with the true drawstring and jeans with Swiss cheese knees, I could almost dance up the driveway and onto the porch. I ring the doorbell, and with his free hand, Chad palms back his hair, wet and peaked with rain. The narrow young face of the home aide floats in the window. Hello? She answers the door, still hung with a glittery Valentine's Day wreath of pink hearts speared with arrows. Without her own coat on, I can see she's hugely pregnant under a tent of a sweater. Hi! I chirp, and repeat the story of the school project, the long-lost aunt. I'm getting pretty slick at lying my way into people's homes, which I don't think is wrong. Maybe just Machiavellian? So Tilly's neighbor said she might be the best person to help us, since she knows a lot of what happens in town. The aide laughs. He's not wrong. Just hold on while I ask Tilly. She might be tired out. 10 minutes later, and with glasses of lime seltzer in our hands, and a bowl of licorice hard candies in front of us, Chad and I are sitting down on the couch in Tilly's living room. There's a definite theme going on. Framed embroideries of shamrocks and saints. And those little hand-heart crown combos all over. On the shelf above the fireplace are dozens of little ceramic leprechauns. In an armchair, under a big stained glass wall hanging of the green, white, and orange Irish flag, sits Tilly Donahue, a hawk-nosed, coral-lipped, bird-boned woman in a caramel velour tracksuit. There are a dozen rings at least on her bent fingers, big, polished hunks of pink and blue and green and tiger eye stone, and she fiddles with the cellophane wrapper on licorice after licorice. She's only too happy to talk. She's already complained to us about the weather, her sore hip, her nasal congestion, and her cataracts with the same pride in her cloudy eyes as a collector showing off her prized postage stamps. The aide retreated to the kitchen after settling Tilly in. Probably she's heard all of this 3 times today already. When I tell Tilly I'm looking for one of the fays, "The Protestants down the street," she calls them. She really gets revved up. "The mother, she ran off early, when the girl was, 8 or 9. Siobhan was a strange fruit. And that poor Sidonie, she never had much chance at normal. Do you know she used to knock on my door and ask for things like milk? Because her father used to forget to buy it. Imagine, a little girl in the house, and you don't buy milk. And the milkman hadn't been coming around for 15 years. The father always offered to shovel my driveway after a big one. Before he was taken, they shipped the girl across town. But he went away on business a lot. And anyway, a little girl needs a mother, or else they don't learn how to act. I think it must be why all these girls on TV are going to jail and showing around their privates. They show their privates in the streets like parade floats." Chad splutters around a sip of seltzer. I have 0% desire to hear Tilly Donahue's theories on why motherless girls like me grow up to show around their privates, but she seems to be waiting for my answer. For something to do, I peel the wrapper off a licorice and pop it into my mouth. It tastes like the bottom of a 1950s-style Candyman's pocket. "Huh," I gargle, tucking the sugary rock into my cheek. "So do you know what happened to Sidonie when she grew up?" "My mom, Lil, she thought her cousin might have come back to Fitchburg about 5 years ago.
"She did?"
Tilly bobs her head on her thin neck, and this seed of excitement sprouts in me.
"And that was something. 20 years, the Fay girl disappears. No one knows where she went. Then one day,
Margie Goldberg says she saw her in the Stop and Shop with Todd Malachi." She lowers her voice and leans in. "And 1 week, Todd came in and bought ladies' unmentionables."
"Uh-huh. The Malachis used to live over on River Street. I think Sidonie and Todd were little school friends, and they went to church together. They were Protestants, too, you know."
The candy is a sharp-edged, sickly sweet disc between my teeth. "So Sidonie's here now? Staying with Todd?"
"I didn't say that," she answers, clearly having a fantastic time. "You know, Margie's son-in-law is a janitor at New Hope, and he says Todd dropped Sidonie off for all her appointments. And Todd was living over by the bowling alley then, so that was all the way across town."
"What's New Hope?" Chad asks for me.
"The Thorndike Center for New Hope is the whole name. There was a vote in the town hall when they wanted to put it up, and it nearly didn't pass because no one wanted. We were all just worried what kind of people it might attract into town. Do you know I've lived here since I was born? Not in this house the whole time. I grew up in the part of town they called Tar Hill. Now they put up New Hope over there, so who knows what's become of it."
She leans forward again, presses her thin orange-pink lips together.
"It's a place for the mentally unfirm."
I can't get the words "troubled waters" out of my head.
"It's a mental hospital?" "I don't know what you call it. More like..."
Her old forehead crinkles in thought.
"What are those places where the drunks meet up to talk about being drunks?
Alcoholics Anonymous?
Yes, but for the unfirm. That's how they explained it to us at Town Hall, anyway.
I don't really know what any of this means, but Tilly plows right on through.
Margie, she's the one of them that works at Stop and Shop ever since she mostly retired. She says Todd used to pick up her prescriptions for her sometimes. For Sidoni, I mean. She lets out a hoarse clap of laughter.
That's really something, isn't it?
Do you know, those two went to their high school prom together?
So Todd is the tall boy standing behind Mom in his big-shouldered suit. I guess he really was thrilled to be with her. Do they still live by that bowling alley?
Oh, no.
Tilly leans back, working at another candy wrapper. I just want to smack it out of her grip, and maybe Chad senses this, because he squeezes my hand in his. With a little squawk of victory, she fishes out the licorice and pops it in her mouth.
He moved away about 2 years ago. Hilda Malachi, that's his great aunt, says he works at a college in Connecticut now.
What's the big one?
UConn? Chad offers. Yes, that's it. I want to say, not a teacher, though. She sniffs. Something in the office.
Did my mom's cousin... Did she go with him when he left town?
I don't know. I wouldn't guess so. Might be Hilda could tell you. Though I don't think she'll be much help. She's not altogether firm herself. Touch of the dementia, poor thing. Mostly we see each other over at the church. She's there an awful lot. Her homemade brings her over. I go every Sunday myself. Who sins enough to go every day?
Do you know how we can get in touch with her? I ask. A lead is a lead.
I don't think I should give her number out. You never know what people can do with that information. Everything you hear on the news about identity theft.
Chad and I exchange side eyes. Do I seem likely to steal the identity of a senile, serial churchgoer?
Oh, that's too bad. I'd really love to talk to your friend. I suppose I can call her up.
Tilly's smile sharpens, thrilled to play a part in the little drama unfolding before her. When Hilda answers, Tilly catches her up, at top volume and with much repetition, about me and my mission to find my aunt. Then she hands me the receiver of her clunky, corded phone, keeping a finger curled in the wire. I speak to Hilda on a short leash.
Hi, Mrs. Malachi. I really appreciate your taking the time to...
Hello?
Hi?
Across from me, Chad winces. We're off to a rocky start.
Tilly said you have questions for me.
Hilda's sandpaper voice rasps across the receiver.
About one of Todd's old girlfriends?
Sidoni Fay. Yes, your friend says she used to live with Todd, above the bowling alley?
Oh, I don't know. That's asking a lot of me.
Her head cocked toward the receiver to hear, Tilly nods, looking a little victorious to be proven right.
He's very handsome, like his grandfather Jacob, Hilda continues. My brother had so many sweethearts when he was young. So did Todd. He always had another little girlfriend to bring around the holidays.
This one would have been just 2 or 3 years ago. She had brown hair and hazel eyes. She was small, and I guess she might have been a little sick at the time, or just troubled. It's not much, as vital statistics go, but Hilda surprises me by answering,
There was one girl who went around with him. She was trouble. Made his father so upset. It broke his heart. She was a pretty little white girl, but she was crazier than a sack of raccoons, would borrow money from Todd because she didn't work, crashed this truck he had at the time, all kinds of problems. But I thought that was a while back. My nephew passed when that second Bush was still president. Or was that my cousin's son? Oh, there's too many of them to keep track.
So Hilda's not the most reliable source, but I don't want her sketchy memory for details to distract me from the big picture. Do you think it's possible Todd kept in touch with her?
Well, I don't know why he would. His mother says he's married now to a lovely woman in New York, but who knows? He doesn't come home much, doesn't report in to me. I don't even have his number.
You mean Connecticut?
What's that?
He's in Connecticut, not New York, right? I thought he worked at UConn.
Sure. Maybe he does.
All right, that's helpful. Thanks.
Having heard the whole conversation, Tilly sips her seltzer primly and says when I've hung up,
"You know, ever since Siobhan went off the rails, I knew her little girl was headed for a hard time."
We can't get out of there fast enough. We head back to Sugarbrook as the sky really opens up, and icy raindrops the size of pebbles pelt the car roof. We drive in silence, deafened. But I'm not sulking. We're closing in on Sidonie Fay. When Dad and I find her, it won't matter that she quit a few jobs and crashed her ex-boyfriend's truck and went a little off the rails. She'll have her family to help her out. Besides, I knew she was troubled waters from the start. This was never going to be easy. Without thinking, I smile over at Chad.
Want to help us track down Todd Malachi?
That's the spirit, he says, and shakes me gently by the neck the way he does when we play video games. His hand is big and dry and warm. When we're almost home, we drive ahead of the weather, and the clouds turn white all at once, and the last bit of sun streaks through. I think there must be a rainbow somewhere, with the road still glittering. While we're stopped at a light, I crane my neck around to search the gray block of sky behind me. But there's nothing there.
15.
You're spending quite a lot of time with them. Lindy works to free the zipper where it's caught on the black plastic.
I don't want you getting in their hair.
Oh, Immy, she gasps. Red fabric tumbles out of the bag.
You're going to look so beautiful. Did you try it on? Do you love it?
Is it my imagination, or are my stepmother's cool blue eyes a little dewy?
I guess. It's no big deal or anything.
It is a big deal, she corrects me.
I just can't believe how mature you are. You're almost a grown-up.
I don't like the almost part. I'm the grown-up who's hot on my dad's trail. Not Lindy, not Officer Griffin, not anybody older or supposedly more mature than me. But it doesn't help my case to argue the compliment.
Thanks, Lindy.
Running her fingers over the skirt of the dress, the slightly plunging neckline, and the thick red halter straps, she sighs.
I want you to know how proud I am of you, Immy, of how you're handling yourself in all of this. And I